Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. After much speculation, Fairfax Media has finally confirmed its bidding farewell to its digital rivers of gold. The publisher of the Sydney Morning Herald, The Age, and The Australian Financial Review is planning to list its lucrative real estate website domain on the stock exchange by the end of this year. So what does this mean for the newspapers, which have been on the chopping block for the last several years? Fran Kelly speaks next to the chief executive of Fairfax Media, Greg Highwood.
Oh, well, you've got to remember that we'll be owning 60 or 70%, so Fairfax will control domain. It will control the board. What this means, Fran, is it just underlines the success of the strategy that we've been embarking on. I mean, what modern publishing is about has to be more than advertising, which is fragmenting and quite stressed. It has to be more about subscriptions that can do some of the job, but not all of the commercial job. And what we've done at Fairfax is make sure that we use our key assets in our publishing business, which is our very large audiences and our marketing inventory that we have within our publications and our sites, and we drive new businesses. And that's what the success of Domain's been about. It's got a great team, a good strategy, but we've really, really driven that business out of the publication. So we're using our publishing businesses to drive value. Now, the fact that it's become big enough and independent enough to be separately listed is an incredible success story for the organisation.
Isn't the success story of a publisher like Fairfax about putting out fantastic news publications? Isn't it about great journalism? So yeah, where does this fit with this? How does this work?
That is exactly right. I mean, we wouldn't have those very large audiences unless we put out fabulous journalism. So it is a virtuous loop here we're talking about. The great journalism providing the great audiences and those audiences being instrumental in driving new businesses. And it's not just Domain. We have the streaming video on demand business, Stan, and we're doing the same with that. You can pick up the papers, you can look at our sites, and you can see wraps of the paper or advertising within the paper around Domain's mobile app, around Stan's programming. We're doing it with our Drive business. We've got a joint venture around our Drive brand now. We're doing the same thing. But I hark back to what I said. You know, the publishing business has been in incredible structural stress since the advent of the internet 20 years ago. The issue for publishers, commercial publishers, I mean, we don't get a government check written, right? What we have to do is do our public good, which is our journalism, and we have to do it in a commercial model, and that commercial model has profoundly changed.
And as you say, it's been in structural success, and we've had conversations, you and I, over the years about the threat to the weekday print editions of The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald, for instance, which really looked on the way out at the moment. I'll come back to that. Mm. But are you saying this strategy, the decision to hold on to the majority stake, gives you the benefit of an influx of cash when it's listed, but the cash keeps coming in to underpin the journalism and just keep the newspapers alive longer? Is that the strategy?
We've got the value of Domain inside our business. We own 60 that we'll own if it is separated, because we have to go through a process around this. But if it is separated, we'll own 60 to 70% of the business. And
that will keep the newspapers alive longer.
It's all about this virtuous loop. And that's what I'm saying. We have created a strategy around publishing that goes beyond the dependence upon advertising and circulation. And that is what this is about. And we're doing it with Stan, and we're doing it with Drive, and we're doing it with our events business. We just have to remake the model.
Talking of Stan, with the main split off, there's a lot of speculation that ultimately it'll make it easier for you to sell or merge the newspaper business, and you could sell it to Channel 9. You're talking about Stan there, that's a joint venture with 9. Is that part of the strategy?
Look, there's a lot of overexcited speculation around this, and you know what listed companies don't do is speculate on that sort of material. But look, let me underpin the fact that with media laws changing, media businesses are talking to each other about what it means for each other. I mean, that is, we wouldn't be doing our job. But that is a long way from saying that there's a deal on the table or a deal being agreed or whatever. We have very good relationships with our colleagues at Nine. We have very good relationships across the industry. But that doesn't mean that there's a deal on the table that's going to be signed off, far from it.
No, but it does sound like confirmation that you're at least discussing with Nine and perhaps others about the notion of creating a media business that is has the newspapers within it.
Media businesses always talk to each other. They have to talk to each other, particularly given the fact that media laws are changing or are likely to change. Now, I don't know whether they're going to change next month or in a year's time, but what we do know is that the current legislation, which imposes the 2 out of 3 rule and the reach rule, is just completely irrelevant. It's so past its use-by date, it smells. I mean, it's ridiculous. It was relevant, perhaps, prior to the advent of the internet, but the internet has dealt with the diversity issues which are inherent in that legislation, and now it's about making sure that traditional media players that deliver local content and local news and information can work together, right, to find the best commercial outcome. I mean, this is a world where substantial components of the display market, advertising market, which basically provides the dollars for the journalism, a lot of that money is going to Google and Facebook. So we have to operate in a traditional media environment to grab as much of those dollars as possible. And the current legislation precludes us from working together more effectively.
You're listening to RN Breakfast. It's 14 past 8. Our guest is Greg Highwood, the Chief Executive of Fairfax Media, publishers of the Sydney Morning Herald, The Age and The Fin Review. Yesterday you painted a more upbeat picture of the prospects for the weekday printed newspapers. It wasn't that long ago. You know, in the last few years, you'd signalled that, well, perhaps reality will bite and we'll end the weekday print editions. What's changed?
Nothing's changed.
So are they safe
we've,
or not?
We've said for the last 5 or 6 years, and being really frank about this, that the internet is the information technology of now and the future, that print has a limited future. We certainly think there's some years yet in the printed product. That an alternative down the track could be weekend-only printing and 24/7 digital. But we're not there yet. You know, we've done the work. We've looked at advertising trends in print. We've looked at subscription trends, which are growing. And we've decided that daily printing for some years yet is the right thing for the company. It's right for the audience that wants its journalism via newspapers. And it's right for shareholders because it's the best commercial outcome.
I'm imagining, and I think it's proven, that the rise to power of Donald Trump in the US has been very good for media around the world, print or digital, in terms of sales and eyes on. But are you at Fairfax talking about the role of the media at a time like this when, you know, fake news is being bandied about by no less than the President of the United States and the truth seems to be becoming increasingly elusive?
Well, as you know, I was a journalist and editor before I became a manager of the company. This company is about journalism. I mean, we deliver a public good through our journalism. We provide the transparency into institutions and powerful individuals that this community needs to be open and transparent. I mean, it is absolutely critical to our democracy. It's the core of what we do. What we have to do is adjust to the commercial realities of a very, very different world when there were only newspapers and free-to-air and radio in the marketplace and advertisers could only really get their message out via those mediums. It's a very different place and we have to change. And we've done a lot in this company. The management team's done a lot in this company, A, to face up to that reality and B, deal with it. And the separation of domain, as I said, is critical because what that has done is prove the strategy that we've put in place works.
So Fairfax newspapers are out of the woods?
Fairfax newspapers will be there as long as they're commercially viable, as long as there's an audience that wants to buy them, and as long as there's advertisers that want to advertise them.
Okay.
That is the same for any business.
Well, people listening are keen for some advice. Mick has texted us. He asked if he should sell his Fairfax shares and buy Domain shares instead.
Well, I would always support people buying Fairfax shares, and I would always support people buying Domain shares.
Greg Highwood, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Greg Highwood is the chief executive of Fairfax Media. He was speaking there with Fran Kelly. You're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International.
The Spectrum Monitor is a monthly electronic magazine covering shortwave, amateur radio, scanning, satellites, Wi-Fi, and vintage radio, which is available for any device capable of opening a PDF file.
Charlie 105, it is PDF to journal.
The Spectrum Monitor also covers amateur radio satellites, maritime and military monitoring on shortwave, reviews of receivers, scanners, and software used for shortwave, and more. Annual subscriptions for 12 issues is only $24, with individual monthly issues available for $3 each. If you're already a subscriber, you can renew your subscription by clicking on the Sign Up for 2015 button. MasterCard, Visa, Discover, and PayPal are accepted. For more details, visit our website at www.thespectrummonitor.com.
Well, next on the program, actually, we have something rather interesting. It's about the music industry. Almost. It's about recording techniques. Almost. It's about recording music for BBC television. Almost. Actually, it's kind of a mixture of all those things. Now, if I mention the name John Coleshaw, many of you may have never heard of him, but he was a pioneering English classical record producer for Decca Records. He recorded a wide range of music, but he's known for masterminding the first studio recording of Wagner's Der Ring des Nibelungen, which was done in 1958. He left Decca to go to Capitol for a short time, then returned back to Decca, and was one of the first producers to employ the new stereo recording technique for the label. And he also pioneered many of those early stereo recordings. He later on quit Decca in 1967 and then was appointed the head of music production for BBC Television, where he remained until his retirement in 1975. He was a bit of a maverick in the sense that everything that had been done in the sense of recording classical music for broadcast, he threw all that away and was always experimenting to provide the best sound possible. He died April 27th, 1980. But in the late 1970s, Tom Meyer of Radio Nederland met up with this fascinating man and talked about music, recording techniques, and the future of recorded music on both disc and television.
What exactly is your title right now, if you want to call it that?
I'm head of music programs for BBC Television in London.
Yes, but you haven't been doing this all the time, have you? Before that, you did something else.
Yes, I was in charge of the classical recordings for Decca in London.
And especially, I think, the recording of the Ring Cycle is something that you're very proud of, isn't it?
Well, yes, it was, took 8 years to make it, and it's a long time. Of course, it wasn't by any means the only thing. I and my colleagues did very many other opera recordings as well, but The Ring is, of course, larger than anything else, so everybody talks about The Ring.
Is this the first time in the history of the record that this whole cycle has been recorded?
Yes, it's the first time. It started in 1958 with Rheingold. In fact, the anniversary is next Tuesday, the 24th.
Oh, really?
It's 10 years since we actually started it.
So another thing to celebrate.
Yes, I'm going to have a little party with Shorty on Tuesday night. Get now, very drunk.
Good. Now, I'm sure that you have some very personal views of the importance of the record in nowadays cultural life. There's something that I've been wondering about. Would you say that the gramophone record would tend to have more people be interested in classical music? Or do you think it would work the other way around, that because people can buy records, they won't go to concerts as much as they used to?
Well, it's the two questions, and it's very hard to answer them. I mean, first of all, I think it's been of enormous cultural advantage. I'm going to say tomorrow that I think it's the gramophone record in the last few decades has done more to spread serious music, or indeed any music, than any other medium, including radio, I think.
Yes.
This has gathered enormous force since, of course, LP was invented, whenever it was, in the late 40s or early 50s. I don't believe that the gramophone record keeps people away from the concert hall or the opera house. I think it will encourage them actually to go. On the other hand, it does make people, standards, technical standards being what they now are, it will tend to keep people away from bad concert halls. Now, of course, in Amsterdam, you have perhaps the greatest concert hall in Europe. I'm not just saying that because I'm here. Right? I've always loved the Concertgebouw. I think it's a great, great hall. But there are places that I know of, and you know of probably, where the concert halls are dreadful.
Yes.
And then I can't blame people for preferring to stay at home with their very expensive equipment and listening to records in domestic conditions.
Yes, and putting their own program together.
Indeed. And interrupting it when they like.
Right.
And adjusting the sound to what they like. Of course, there is a basic difference between the human being listening at home and as a member of an audience of 2,000 people. One reacts differently, of course.
Right.
It's a different experience altogether.
That's what I was going to come to next, because provided that someone has a perfect equipment at home, let's say he has 100% perfect stereo equipment, what do you think are the basic differences between someone listening at home, listening to what he wants to listen to, or being part of a big audience?
Well, it's, I don't know how to define it. I just know that there is a difference. I think, let's take it on a very simple level. When you are in an audience, you are a member of a herd. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, it's a perfectly healthy thing to be. But you do react with that audience, don't you? I mean, if it's a comic opera, say, and let's talk about opera for a moment, you tend to laugh when the audience laughs. You react. You can't help reacting with the community. And I think even in the concert hall, there's a sort of mood comes over the place. I'm sure there will be a mood when Bernstein conducts here.
Right.
You know, a particular mood which is created by the artist in the hall on that occasion. And everybody, or more or less everyone, responds to that. A certain sort of electricity that one can't... I can't define it. I'm not a sociologist or a psychiatrist. And that's essentially different from being in your own surroundings, in your own apartment, your own house, with your own equipment, with your own family.
Right.
And also, you are completely in control of the music then. I mean, you can alter the sound, you can interrupt it, you can, if you get bored with it, you can switch it off, you can have a drink while it's going on. You are a different person then. And you are therefore going to react differently.
Yes.
Imagine somebody as a member of a large audience listening to say, Tristan in the theatre, and the same person listening to Tristan at home, where he's absolutely immersed in the sound.
Yes.
There's a great difference.
Do you think that the technique of recording and the technical qualities of nowadays recordings are, in fact, so good that you could say that at home you can get as good a sound as in a good opera house or a good concert hall? Because I know that some people disagree there. They say, well, however good your equipment is, you will never get the same sound. They're now talking about sound and not about atmosphere.
Clearly, you cannot get the same sound because most of us don't live in palaces.
Right.
And it's impossible to put a 100-piece symphony orchestra into one's living room. So clearly, the sound as such is different. It's basically, it's quite different. The gramophone record is not an imitation of a concert hall or of an opera house. So therefore, there's no really valid comparison between what you hear in a concert hall and what you hear at home. You can't say one is better than another. They're just, than the other, they're just totally different. But I think on good equipment, a modern gramophone record provides something that would have been unthinkable even 20 years ago. If it's a well-made record and if the equipment is properly regulated, it is a thoroughly musical sound.
Yeah.
But it's not the same as the concert hall.
Right. What are your views on, let's say, the future of the gramophone record? Do you think they're going to be very special developments, very let's say that developments that people don't expect now, unexpected things are going to happen in the recording business?
Who knows? Nobody believed in, 1955, only 3 or 4 years after LP had been invented,
right,
that within 2 years there'd be this tremendous upheaval with stereo, which has now just about killed mono. I don't know how it is in Holland, but, you know, there are no more mono records, really, in England, none in America. Heaven knows what the next development will be. Everybody seems to think it will be, of course, in the direction of the field in which I'm working now, which is video, you know, sort of vision as well as sound. My goodness, when if it comes to that, the problems, of course, will be, are enormous, I know.
So you mean that by putting on a record, you won't only have the sound, but also the picture?
Whether it's a record or a tape or,
yes,
or
well,
a piece of wire, whatever it turns out to be, you know. I mean, the point is, well, if it becomes possible, if it becomes marketable, if it's a commercial possibility, which I gather at the moment it isn't, then, goodness, the record industry will have its problems, as we now have in television. I mean, trying to make this thing work in a visual medium, it's terrible.
As far as things that you would like to record in the future, what is your biggest ideal? What is your greatest wish?
Well, do you mean for television or for... Well, that's very hard to answer. In television, although we have an enormous output at the BBC, we are still, frankly, in the experimental stage with music, and we probably shall be, like everyone else, for a few more years. So it would be really silly of me to say that I would love to do, Tristan or Meistersinger or something on the box, but it's far too soon to do it.
Right.
Even if I could get the money, which one probably could actually, but it's far too soon to do it. The screen isn't big enough for one thing. That's got to expand before we tackle that sort of thing. The sound isn't good enough. That's another. So far as the record industry goes, and of course I'm not connected with it any longer directly. It seems to me that they're fulfilling a marvellous task of closing all the gaps in the repertoire. I mean, almost every month something appears from one company or another which provides the record collector with a work which was hitherto inaccessible.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Do you think that television in the future will be using stereo too?
I should think it's unlikely, because don't think that the small screen that we now have, I mean, even measuring by our largest domestic receiver, is large enough to be compatible with a stereo sound. I mean, after all, the average person who's got stereo in the average room like this one has a sound spectrum which is several meters wide.
Yes.
Well,
what's our largest screen,
you
yes.
know, it's very small. And I don't see how you reconcile that sort of sound with this sort of picture. No, I think the first thing we need to do is improve the mono sound on television, if we possibly can, which means, of course, that the responsibility goes to the manufacturers to make sets with a better audio end than at present. They're not being very helpful. But that's the first step. Let's get the mono right, and then maybe in a few years' time screens will grow larger. There are already rumours from Japan and America about some completely new system of the flat screen without a cathode ray tube. I'm not a technician, I don't know, but I've said for a long time I believe that in a certain number of years we shall have a flat screen which you hang on the wall like a picture. And you have it cut according to the size of your room?
Yes.
I'm sure that will be possible.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say lots of success with the developments at BBC Television, and maybe we'll see you again to hear about some new developments.
Thank you very much indeed. Well, I hope so.
John Culshaw, formerly of BBC Television, as the music department of BBC Television, and before that with Decca Records. He's a legendary producer, and Tom Meyer was speaking to him in the 1970s. Now, we decided to use that today because it is interesting when you listen to archive interviews like that, especially when they talk about technology, and you know, something is, of course, that people predicted in the 1960s and 70s actually have happened, but others haven't. Many people may have heard of something called quadraphonic recordings. Well, quadraphonic recordings actually did sound fantastic, but it had a very short life, and we're actually preparing to do a special program on that and what actually happened to them. Anyway, you are listening to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. Now time for propagation. Here's our propagation editor, Glenn Hauser.
Keith from IPS in Australia, the global HF propagation forecast through February 25th. Normal to fair at all latitudes. From Space Weather South Africa through February 25th, magnetic conditions unsettled, shortwave fadeouts unlikely, MUF unstable. From Met Office UK, geomagnetic activity mainly quiet February 25th and 26th. From FK Yanda in Prague, the geomagnetic field will be quiet to active on February 25th, March 3rd and 6th. Quiet on February 26th, March 8th, 11th and 12th. Active to disturbed February 27th, 28th, March 1st, 2nd and 5th. Quiet to unsettled, March 4th, 7th, 13th to 15th. Mostly quiet on March 9th and 10th. From SWPC in Boulder, geomagnetic field activity is expected to reach G2 moderate storm levels on February 28th, with ANK indices of 30 and 6, and G1 minor storm levels on February 24th, March 1st and 16th, with A's and K's of 20 and 5. Lowest A's and K's of 5 and 2 on March 7th to 14th. Solar flux declining from 82 on February 25th to 72 on March 5th, and up to 79 by March 18th. William Hepburn's VHF, UHF, DX maps show extreme tropospheric ducting along the Texas-Tamaulipas coast February 24th, off the coast of Namibia February 27th and 28th, between Arabia and India all week, between India and Southeast Asia February 24th and 25th, and off the west coast of Australia February 24th to 27th.
Thanks, Glenn. And with that, well, we've come to the end of the program. If you want to contact us to let us know what you think, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is very simple. It's mnp@pcjmedia.com. Once again, mnp@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Parent, wishing you all. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye. 73 and 88 to the ladies.